Are we rolling? Yeah, and you can see the level down
there. Yeah, looks good.
Great. We're professional podcasters.
That we are. Hello and welcome to A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. My name is Michael Bates.
This is Dave Douglas.
And we're getting up there. Got a lot of episodes under our belt.
We enjoy it. We enjoyed hearing from Jazz Times that put us on a some sort of poll, and apparently we almost won, so that was a big surprise. We're happy that people are listening. It's musicians talking to musicians. That's what I find really interesting, and every artist that we've had on the show is unique and remarkable and special, and today is no different.
Yeah, no different. We have a fantastic guitar player and conceptualist and composer, Mary Halverson, and this is an interview that we did with her.
Number the compositions that have to do with my trio, quintet, or septet for whatever reason.
Right, so you've got like one for your trio and it's number 39 and right. It's Crashes Like Lights.
Mm-hmm. Why?
It's a cataloging thing, right?
It's basically a cataloging thing, yeah. And it's also a slight nod to Anthony Braxton.
Right.
But the reason I did it initially is because I title the songs after the fact. So when I'm composing, I need some kind of a placeholder there so I can keep track. And then I thought, initially I just did that and then I intended to get rid of the numbers. But then I thought, well, I might as well leave them in because it's also a way for me to keep track of, you know, some kind of how the compositions are developing or not developing or whatever, so I kind of leave the numbers in there so then I know 10 is an earlier one. And
I made myself stop putting numbers on the tunes or saying tune A, tune B, because then it would end up sticking. And
yep.
I had all these tunes. That's what the association became for me. So now I make myself give them names, even if they're really stupid names. And I find that then when I pull the tune out to give it to the band, the title is so embarrassing that I immediately come up with something.
That's funny. Well, yeah, my band usually doesn't learn the title. They know the tunes by the numbers. So
right.
Then we'll be on a gig and I'll be announcing, oh, now we're going to play Crashes Like Lights. And everyone's like, which one is that? So then I kind of have to say the number.
Better than New Waltz or New
right.
Waltz.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Or Curtis Hasselbring had a really funny thing.
New
I was playing
one.
In his band. It would be like, new tune that's actually really old. New version of old tune. Like his titles would all be things like that. It was hilarious.
Thank you. who's on this trio recording?
That's with John Avare on bass and Chess Smith on drums.
And you guys have been together a while now, right?
Yeah, I think the first gig was in 2007. So it's been a band, I guess, yeah, about 7 years.
So great. This is going to sound really stupid. I'm trying to think of how to formulate the question, but when you're writing, what do you think? Your tunes like come from such a unique place.
Yeah, in a way, they're also like really episodic too. You know, in a way, there's a lot of information in each tune.
Well, I guess that it probably comes across that way because I don't plan them out. I don't think about them at all before I sit down to write them. So I don't have any kind of an overarching structure determined. So I'll just start, and then it's kind of like train of thought. I'll go. So sometimes they end up in completely different places than they started because I don't have any kind of a preconceived notion.
Melodies, chords, that's just like spilling out in the heat of the moment.
Well,
as you're writing.
Initially, I'll spend a bunch of time usually just improvising on guitar, trying to get some kind of an idea, like an initial idea, and that could be anything. It could be a chord or a melodic line or a combination. And then that's the hardest part for me, to get some kind of an idea. That could take a really long time. But then once I have that, it's just go. And usually I write them pretty quickly.
Wow.
And do you have any methodology for sort of expanding and letting the material evolve through the composition? Because, you know, when I hear this stuff, it's so thematically written, but it's also, like I said, it's just, there's a lot of information happening that seems to be derived from the original idea.
Yeah, I think I do that a lot, is take an idea and then, you know, move it around, orchestrate it differently or change it or take, usually it is related in some respect, but it might get so drastically different that doesn't always come across.
Do you have any like retrograde or something like that, like a techniques that you use, or do you think about it like that?
Not really.
No.
Sometimes I'll do things like I'll harmonize a melody and then I'll take the new harmony you know, things like that. But I don't think I have any kind of a real system in place that something I'll do.
Okay.
Sometimes I'll just put random notes down and see how those sound. Sometimes to me it feels like, you know, even if it was a bunch of random notes, if I literally wrote random notes and then you kind of take the ones you don't like and change them. So it's almost like carving something.
Is that a function of the way that you improvise then, would you say? Like, do you see those activities as analogous?
I guess so. I guess in a way they are. Maybe in the sense of I try to not think too much about what I'm doing. Yeah, I guess I try to have things not be predictable. I mean, that is something I try to do, but then of course that in itself becomes predictable.
Yeah.
So
right. There's no,
and then that gets back to why thinking is bad, because then you think yourself in a circle.
Interesting. And there's no number, so this is a special group.
Yeah, it's a different group.
And yet, you know, just by dint of that title, you know, it sounds like you definitely had an objective in mind when you wrote this.
Right, and that's for a collective band, although I did write that tune.
Mike Formanek and...
Toma Fujiwara.
Right.
That tune really appeals to my inner teenager. It's pretty rocking.
That's funny. Yeah, I guess I, you know... A lot of times if I'm writing, I'll be trying to think about balance. So I'd probably just written a ballad or something, and I thought, oh, I need something, you know, to kind of even out that energy or have a different kind of energy. And the band being called Thumbscrew has that kind of connotation. A kind of edge to it. So, I mean, I guess I probably wouldn't think about it any more than that when I sit down to write it.
So you are thinking about who you're playing, who you're writing it for.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
In every case.
Always. If I'm going to compose, I know when I sit down, I say, I'm going to compose a piece for septet. So I know that, but it might start on the guitar.
That's a beautiful, like in terms of sort of the pyramid effect that you have in the horns, and it's really effective. And it doesn't sound like something that would sit well on the guitar. Like it's sort of like, you know, maybe
right.
A composition.
Yeah, that I was probably off the guitar at the point. You know, I honestly sometimes I don't remember, you know, what, for that particular one, it could have been the guitar line that came first, and then I kind of added these horn things almost as if they were piano chords or something.
Who's on alto saxophone?
John Arabagon.
It's kind of amazing, right? Like,
He's such a bad alto player.
Well, you know what? I've done a couple gigs with him right after he's played with your band. So he's had his tenor with him.
Right.
So he said, well, I just played this gig with Dave, so I have my tenor. Is it okay if I play tenor?
And then
instead?
What happens? You don't
and
like
I say,
tenor?
No, it's great. What's so funny is because he's so amazing, he just, you know, some of the parts are pretty complicated. But, just no problem. Alto, now he's playing them on tenor.
Yeah, but he's transposing from the alto parts.
I mean, I'll give him a B-flat part, but he just learns. It's like no problem. It's effortless.
But what I find fascinating, like I know his playing pretty well, and there it's almost like there are two different personalities, you know, his
two
good point, but you know, the alto, his sound on alto, and how he plays, the lines he chooses, like it, and then versus tenor, it's really different. Have you noticed that? Or
you know, it's funny, I've played with him so much more on alto than on tenor.
I knew him as an alto player actually initially too.
But, and then recently I did a gig with him, which was an improvised gig, and he was playing a lot of Sofronino.
Wow.
So, but I don't know. I have to say, when he played tenor in my band, I really didn't think it was that different.
Okay.
But it could be that's how he plays in my band.
Right,
as
right,
you know, he is a very diverse musician who does a lot of different things.
That
so,
is true.
Which is something I really admire about John.
Yeah, and also Jonathan Finlayson and the band. So, such a great voice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he has one of my favorite trumpet tones, and also a really diverse musician who can do a ton of different styles of music. And I think that's something I tend to like in musicians, and I tend to look for musicians that, you know, can play these insane compositions and can play over changes and can improvise freely and that kind of have all those elements, because I think that's really nice when I can feel free to incorporate anything into the music, and these guys will come in and nail it.
Like the whole conversation, we keep dancing around, you know, what is the overarching idea? Mm-hmm. And the overarching idea is not to have an idea, to try to not think. And then, right?
But everyone has a language and a voice, and, you know, that certainly comes out. And I think, and that's another thing, and you know, you do the same thing with your bands, but you have a band for a long time, and as it develops, there does become
a language.
And a collective language, and I think that's something I really like. And you know, with the quintet, with the two horns, with John Arabagon and Jonathan Finlayson, I felt like it really took time. It wasn't like instant that we had this language together, but I feel like over time, you know, I bring in a composition, it seems like everyone instantly knows what it should sound like, and it kind of takes form on its own. Mm-hmm. But that takes a while to develop. So
you've been playing with Thomas for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel in some way that when you bring in the tune, you know, he's going to just automatically have an understanding of what you're looking for?
Generally. It's funny. Different musicians are different. Toma will ask me a ton of questions. You know, he'll get the music and a lot of times the answer is, I don't know. Well, do you want this?
Maybe
or are you thinking more?
He wants to know that you don't know.
Okay.
But it's funny because I've noticed that with different musicians, and some of them will really ask, and I tend to not know. You know, usually if I have a specific thing that I want, I'll say it. But oftentimes I like to leave it up to him to figure out how he wants to shape it.
Maybe the conversation goes both ways, that because of the way he plays on your music, mm-hmm. it affects the way that you're writing for the band as well.
Absolutely. And for that band, I wrote a couple tunes that had drum parts, which is something I've never done before.
Wow.
And I have no idea how to write music for drums. So it's hilarious. I mean, I kind of just did it, you know, in Finale, writing right. these stupid sounding drum parts. And so I was kind of self-conscious about it, and Thomas said, no, this is great, because I never would have played this in a million years. So, you know,
just to
bring a totally different thing.
Years and years and years ago, I wrote a drum part for Tom Rainey when we were in a band together called New and Used. And I had never done it before. I was writing by hand, and I put the music on the music stand. His reaction was a little different. He looked at me and he goes, huh, well, I suppose I could do that if that's what you want.
It's perfect. I can picture Tom saying
exactly.
it. And
he never wrote a part for him again.
Oh, that's hilarious.
We'll be right back.
I recently got an Earthquaker pedal, which was, I played at the New York Guitar Festival, and they gave every guitar player that played a free pedal from this company, Earthquaker, which is, it's amazing. And so I got this overdrive pedal, and I've actually been using it all the time. It's a really cool pedal. But everyone got something different. It was so funny. It was like Christmas, like all the guitar players sitting around, what'd you get? Oh, I got this fuzz tone, and I got, so that was funny. So I got an overdrive.
Nice.
But I have a Line 6 delay, which is the guitar, which is the pedal every guitar player has that I've been using
for years.
You have
a really unique way of using it, and it, the effects almost kind of come in like as a part of your line.
Mm-hmm.
Like you'll, like my experience with a lot of guitar players is it's sort of, you know, it's like they'll use an effect, they'll use a loop, and it'll go. But this is like you're taking a solo, and at in you know in the middle of a line, it'll go, you know,
right.
something, and it's really unique.
Well, I kind of think about it like an accent, you know, so it's not the main thing, but it's just a little way to put a little flourish or an accent on something. So I like using that, and I have a foot pedal to control it, so I'm not reaching down to turn a knob, which
I
makes
see.
It much more, much
more
easier for
fluid,
it to become
yeah.
a fluid thing. And then I do a lot of custom tremolo with a volume pedal. So actually I'm using 2 feet, and I realized because I haven't stood up when I played in years, and I realized now I actually couldn't, because then I can't simultaneously work 2 foot pedals if I'm standing, so now I'm stuck sitting down, but that's okay.
It's your thing.
Cool.
That's really interesting. Now you have to make John or Robigan sit down. I think that would be nice.
Poor John.
In his little quarantine corner away from everyone else.
He's only going to be allowed to play Sopranino from
yep.
going forward.
Well, hopefully he'll listen to this podcast.
I know
you mean like he'll get some tips, some pointers? Yeah.
No, I mean so he can hear all the trash we're talking about him.
Oh, he knows.
That's
he doesn't need to
this is a common
podcast.
Theme in a lot of the movies. Anytime his name comes up.
Wow.
Working with Chess for a long time, and it's, you know, you really get to know someone, and it becomes easier to write for somebody.
Did you meet him before you were in New York?
Chess?
Yeah.
No, I met him maybe a year after I had moved here.
Okay.
We were playing in Trevor Dunn's trio.
Right.
So we did a whole bunch of touring together. You know, I remember I was too young to drive the rental car, and everyone would tease me because I was 24. But, you know...
Wait a minute. Do you have to be 25 to rent?
Yeah, you have
yeah.
to. I think
to,
her 26.
Drive,
is it 25 or 26?
25. Yeah.
Wow.
You can't drive the rental car, which is great. I hate driving, so it was great. I could not drive and also not feel guilty. but, so we've been working together for a long time, and I think it does, you know, it becomes, like all the stuff we're talking about, it becomes so much easier, and, you know, and I play in Chess's band also, so you... And Thomas, you know, so you work with these people and you start to have a sense of their sound and what they want. And I think it's
yeah.
really nice. I think having, you know, I mean, it's great to play with new musicians too, but I think having, for me, having these bands for a long time and these musical relationships for a long time is.
Communities, really.
Yeah, and communities, I mean, exactly.
Everybody in your septet is kind of part of a pretty big scene, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's really nice because, you know, they're also, I mean, the other important thing is I really like these people. They're people I'd want to hang out with and I'd want to travel with and I trust. And, you know, so for me, that's a huge factor, you know.
Wow. It's different than the old days, isn't it?
Totally different. And my tolerance for BS has gone way down and these people don't give me any BS.
Well, that's good. You got to get that. Not only do they drive the car, but they also run interference for you with all the BS in the world.
Yeah. So that's a band. It kind of started as a collective band, and then it's called Reverse Blue. And the thing that sometimes, although not always, but sometimes happens with collective bands is nobody does anything, so nothing happens. So I just took charge of it, and I wrote a bunch of music, and I thought, well, I don't need another band, but that's kind of just what happened.
And so it's a quartet with
Chris Speed,
right?
And he's playing clarinet and tenor on it. Mm-hmm. Toma Fujiwara on drums, and Ivan Opsvik on bass. Nice. And it actually started as, do you remember when the Search and Restore guys were doing those spontaneous construction shows at the Blue Note, so you could get together with, you know, people you hadn't played much with before. And well, obviously I've played with Toma a lot, but I'd never played with Ivan, and I'd never played with Chris Speed, and I thought, oh, that would be fun to kind of mix somebody I have played with a lot with people whose music I've admired for a long time, but I haven't gotten a chance to play with. So we did this improvising gig at the Blue Note, and it was really fun. So then that's when I thought, well, I'll maybe turn this into something, write some music. So now it's actually highly composed, so it's very different from that first performance. But and
the
there's
sound
a few.
It's great on it. Where did you record this?
So they were record. Well, the Reverse Blue album was recorded at the Bunker in Williamsburg, which has actually been one of my favorite places to record recently. I really like it. It's run by a couple guys that actually went to the New School with, who are great guys, great engineers. It's a beautiful space. And
do they have names to share, or would you have to kill me?
I might have to kill you, but I'll tell you anyway. Aaron Nabizi and John Davis are the guys who run it, and it's a great place. So I recorded the Reverse Blue CD there.
So when is this new one coming out? And is that on, what label is that?
That's on Relative Pitch.
Okay.
And that'll be out in sometime in the fall, probably October.
There's a lot of new things coming out on Relative Pitch, right?
Yeah.
New label.
It's a new label, and they put out a ton of stuff. I know the guys. It's two guys who run the label, and I don't know how they put out that much stuff. They're a little bit crazy, maybe. But
do they have names? Or
again.
We may have to go.
This will be my second life.
So. Right. Kevin Riley, who's a friend of mine, and Mike Panico, they're the two guys that run it. And I've got to know them both over the years. They're in New York. They come to a lot of concerts, and that's actually how I met them, just seeing them out at shows all the time.
Fantastic.
So they're really nice, easy to deal with. They really care, and you know, I think they're doing a great thing. And also a pretty diverse range of things that they put out.
Sharing the music with us. It's really great to hear it, really inspiring. And
thank you.
I think, you know, we tried to pin you down on technique and where the music is coming from, and
she dodged it.
Yeah, we weren't really able to. Yeah. And that's incredible.
Yeah.
It's great.
Good work.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right.
So there's your interview with Mary Halvorsen.
My interview.
Figure that out.
Yeah. Amazing.
Well, not your one's interview with Mary Halvorsen, and John Arabagan notwithstanding, you know, that is some really, really remarkable music.
It really, really is.
It's exciting, except when the saxophone comes in.
Well, it's because he's playing alto.
Thank you.
Before we go, I have a question. So at Greenleaf, you've been releasing the PDFs of the scores of some of your older records. So, you know, you can get all the quartet stuff. A few episodes ago, we talked about Millennium Bug from the Leap of Faith record. And then you have the sextet that was a big influence on me, and I really love that music. And on that album, Stargazer, you have a tune called Intuitive Science.
Yep.
And I was looking at the score, and I was wondering if we could talk, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
That tune.
You know, I'm trying to publish sheet music of everything. I'm
everything.
Really close to having the complete Tiny Bell trio scores finished. Huh. There's a great trumpet player named Taylor Barnett in Richmond, Virginia, who I gave him all the handwritten scores, and he's creating a book.
Oh, wow.
And, so the sextet stuff is out, and with each new record, I'm trying to publish the sheet music. 'Cause I think not only do I feel like it might be interesting for people, but I love it when people play the songs.
Yeah.
And it's also a great... One more thing that I enjoy about having Greenleaf Music is it's sort of an umbrella for all the activity of all the musicians involved.
And for people who haven't seen these scores, one of the things to keep in mind, like Dave's tunes of, you know, like I've seen the handwritten scores, and they're so detailed, and they've always been detailed. So you've kind of been writing in a way, like, you know how you, with certain types of musicians, you'll get like kind of a scrawled, sketchy kind of thing, and everybody kind of makes up a piece, and then that's sort of the document.
I wish I could write like that.
You are not so like great. That. Yeah. So this tune, Intuitive Science, mm-hmm. it's got this like great eighth note line, sets up this really fast swing, and then there are all these modulations.
Yeah.
Can you...
Time modulations and mm-hmm. key modulations.
Right.
And I wanted it to be not like a metrical, you know, aren't we clever,
right.
we figured this out, but more like every time the modulation happens, it's kind of approximate,
uh-huh.
and you sort of have to follow whoever in the band is taking the reins on the transformation at that moment. So we're not counting bars,
right.
and we're not really doing a strictly vertical
right.
modulation, but
okay.
it's sort of everything happens touch and go every time it happens.
So and it relies
every time
on
through
the rhythm
chorus,
section. And,
the rhythm section yeah. and the horns and, you know, huh. whoever is the soloist at a given moment has to sort of take charge of how the transformation happens.
When you
and
talk...
It's kind of a blues.
Really?
Like, well, there's four, I can't remember exactly, but there's three or four different areas.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you. It says B center, E center... C
and they're
center.
Sort of related,
yeah.
right? So B center and then E center, if you think about it, it's the four chord.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously it doesn't operate like a traditional blues, but I sort of wanted to find a way that we could create a cyclical motion without having it be the same every time.
Wow.
That we would have to figure it out differently each time. And I got to say, you know, Joey Barron, James Genus, Uri Kane... You know, it was really, really special to
yeah.
have them to record it because they really got into the idea of that.
And the way Joey plays on that is really, that coming out of a couple of solos, just really spectacular. So let's take a listen to Intuitive Science. This is the Dave Douglas Sextet from an album called Stargazer.
Thanks, Michael.